Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
I bet you can't guess what one of my favorite hobbies is. Well, maybe you can. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn, and it's Free for All Friday. We get to let our hair down, we get to relax and learn about all kinds of new and interesting things. Not too long ago, Laura and I were chatting. She said that I need to get a hobby. I mean, I devote myself to her and the kids at home, and I come here at work, and I love my job. I love being an apologist here at Catholic Answers because, one, I get to do the things that I love doing, researching, explaining, and defending the faith, and I do it in a way that I know that it's helping many people. I mean, there's been so many people I've received emails from saying, you know, thank you for the work that you and other people are doing at Catholic Answers. You guys brought me back to the faith. You guys helped me. You helped me to become Catholic. And I always feel humble when people say to me, you know, you brought me into the church. I say, praise be to God. Always, you know, whenever someone wants to praise you, it should always a good habit to turn it back around and say, praise be to God. And I'm just humbled. I'm so humbled that God would choose a knucklehead like me to want to build up the kingdom with. And I'm happy to oblige him wherever I can to be able to do that. And so that's why my two favorite things to do, they're really tied for first place, are doing debates, formal moderated debates, or dialogues that are fair and, you know, are good exchanges with others, but especially doing the debates, or we've got the moderator and we've got that intellectual combat within a fair and well-defined field, but also maybe overtakes debates by just a tiny bit is writing. Writing is my favorite thing to do. I've written 9 books now. I have a Word document here on my computer that has a list of 20 books I want to write. And they're all different things that Catholics haven't touched. When I decide to write a book, I ask myself, is this something that I'm excited about? Is it something that I can write about? And is it something other? I guess there's 4 questions. Am I excited about it? Can I write about it? Have other people written about it? And is there a need for this? So I guess those are the 4 questions I ask when I decide to write a book, for Catholic Answers Press or for whoever. That first, I have to be excited about it. That Catholic Answers actually approached me with a book on the Bible not too long ago, and I thought about writing it, and I sat down, and I started typing, and I couldn't feel the electricity flowing from my fingers. Now, I did write a book already about the Bible, Hard Sayings, a book on Bible difficulties, but this topic they wanted and just the place that I was in my life at that moment, I just couldn't feel it. I couldn't feel the lightning coming out of my fingertips, the electricity. But when I really am excited about something, it's like a magnet draws my fingertips to the keyboard. And I type horribly, by the way. I still use 2-finger henpecked typing. I've typed out 9 books that way, but that's just one of my quirks. And if you study authors, you'll know most authors have quirks. We're unusual people. Most people don't write books. It's a difficult thing, but I love doing it. It's the art that I love doing. I used to enjoy video and camera work. That was something I also enjoyed. I considered that writing with a camera, but that was the art I could do. When I was in the 5th grade, I had an art teacher tell me I was bad at drawing, that I was not good at drawing. Way to go, lady. So when I take a pencil, I can't make a person with that. I can't draw something sensible. My hands can't do that. But I can take words in my mind and put them on a page and I can paint something with words. That's what I can do when I write. And so I feel blessed God has given me that, and I want to use that to glorify him. So Laura said, you write books all the time. You know, you need to have a hobby. And now I've decided I've got my hobby. I want to write fiction. Like, what? So even still at night, I write books, but not nonfiction. I love writing nonfiction. I love putting forward arguments and research and toiling around with footnotes and sources. I love doing that. But now I think it's time I'd like to expand my horizons a little bit. And I want to bring you in on this today here on the podcast on the Council of Trent. And if you like hearing this, if you like learning new things, having dialogues with people, being able to have access to bonus content to build up your faith, like our study series, early access to talks and videos, other great guests are going to come on. I'm going to do a special with Jimmy Akin, hopefully here soon on the podcast. Or did I already do that with Jimmy? I'm kind of recording a few podcasts ahead to get everything lined up because I'm also finishing up my book at work on socialism, why Catholics can't be socialists. But at night, I feel the restlessness. So if you like all that, by the way, go to trenthornpodcast.com. $5 a month or more, you get access to wonderful content. You keep this going. But I, you know, at work, I love writing. And even at night, I get restless. I'm like, oh, I enjoy spending time with my wife, my kids. But especially when they go to bed and I still kind of stay up, I'm like, what am I going to do? And I want to do art. And so I want to write. And so I've had a work of fiction I've been tooling around with for, I started writing it about 2 years ago. I wrote about five chapters, probably five out of 50 chapters in the book. So 10% of it's written. And then it got off my plate for about 2 years because I had so many other things on my plate coming from work and moving from Phoenix to San Diego and other books from Catholic Answers and projects we were working on. I was never able to get back to it. But now I've gotten back to it and I love writing this fiction. And it's hard writing fiction. As I read through it and I write it, I say to myself, man, I really hope this isn't cheesy. Man, I hope this isn't cheesy. Because I have read amateur fiction and some of it is just cringeworthy. Oh, it is just bad to read. But then I think to myself, oh no, what if I'm making these mistakes? So there's ways you can combat that if you want to be a fiction writer. First, and I admit I'm not taking my own advice, read fiction. If you want to be a good fiction writer, read good fiction. All different kinds of fiction, read it, and don't try to imitate it. Just see what others do and discover that natural quirk you have in yourself, that natural gift that you have, whatever it may be. And look, I'm not saying everyone listening, you're going to go out and write the next great American novel, but it's freeing. Maybe when you have time, you know, stop watching TV and get out your laptop or a pen and paper, write just 500 words, a few hundred words, a story with a character that you like, or just a story involving people you know, and just write it, not for anyone else. I think you'll find it to be very cathartic and even healing in some cases, maybe to write a story of how you want your life to go and to write that out and see, okay, what do I do to make that story possible? You know, am I writing a realistic historical fiction or am I writing fantasy here? It really taps in the mind and allows us to do things instead of becoming passive consumers. At least when we read, when you read, it's not like watching television. You have to be engaged in it and you really do get lost in it. And when you read, what makes reading wonderful, now I sound like, you know, someone I should be on Reading Rainbow or something, LeVar Burton, you know, Reading Rainbow. When you read, it allows you to get lost in a story more so than if you were to watch it in a movie or to watch it on television. Now, I'm a bit of a hypocrite here. I don't read a lot of fiction. I hardly read any fiction because in my line of work, I feel like there's so many things I have to know for my job, like just a wide field of history, philosophy, literature, science, theology. I feel like I'll never read enough nonfiction, but I do need to get into fiction because it expands your brain and helps you relate to people. So I'm going to do that more. And part of it is I'm just going to write fiction. So that's something I'm working on. I thought you might enjoy today's podcast, just talking about my dabbles in fiction. I'm not going to reveal the book. I've only revealed details to just a few key people. I'll tell you the genre. Actually, I have an idea for a second book. This first book is a dystopian sci-fi thriller. That's all I can tell you. Few key friends know the plot, general plot, but aside from that, I'm going to keep it close to the vest until I release it. And then maybe I'd love to be done in a year, year and a half. It's not going to be a major tome. I'm sure it'll be probably around 60,000-70,000 words. So nothing, you remember, it isn't Song of Ice and Fire by George R.R. Martin or Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. It isn't 500,000 words or something. I don't think his is 500,000 words, but his are pretty long. It's not that. But what I want to do today is talk about how to write fiction. You might be interested. You read fiction. What goes into it? What are things that we don't think about in fiction? Well, one thing we often don't think about is a style of fiction writing. I'm taking a wonderful, great course on how to be a great fiction writer. And the professor of the course himself has written his own fictional works. And I think if you take a creative writing class, it better be with somebody who's actually successfully published in fiction or nonfiction, whatever it may be. Otherwise, you're just spent giving money to a hack. You know, take a class from someone who knows what they're doing. So in fiction writing, there's two different kinds of fiction writers. There are the architects and the gardeners. So I'm an architect. I do this with my nonfiction. It's probably because I wrote 9 nonfiction books before I started writing fiction. An architect plans out the entire story in his mind, and he has the beats, the developments, the basic plot in his mind, and he's got that all figured out before he starts writing the chapters. He's planned it all out, like this magnificent cathedral. He's got the plan. Now he's going to build brick by brick to reach what he had in mind. Now, he may go back and have to make renovations or change things on the fly when things don't work. I have to do that with my nonfiction books, but I like being the architect. I like having the goal in mind. But there's another type of author called the gardener. So the gardener is somebody who starts with an image, an idea, a person, a character, and they just start writing from that person. And sometimes they can write themselves in a corner, or this can, amateurs really shouldn't be a gardener. It's usually not good. But amateurs can also be architects that confine the story and don't let it grow organically. A good gardener author can take a real good character, someone you believe is a real person, and they grow and they do things in the story because the author is just writing them as they actually behave. A good example of that would be William Faulkner in The Sound and the Fury, that he starts with just the image of a little girl hiding in a tree in dirty underwear. And he just starts with that. And then he goes from that and tells the rest of the story. Who are these people? Why are they doing this? Who are their relations? What do they care about? And they write in that way. So first, there's architect versus the gardener. I'm more of an architect. If you're a gardener, God love you. So, but hey, as my professor says, the only rule in creative writing is you do what works. And so there's different ways of writing. Let's take characters. You may create entirely new characters that you've never experienced in life. You may write from a perspective you've never lived, or you may use characters that you know about or write from a perspective you've lived. You go with whatever works. So when you come to characters, they got to be persons. I don't know of any stories, any books that are published that are just descriptions of nature landscapes, of just like the grass growing and a waterfall. That would be a horribly boring novel. It has to have persons. They may not be human. They could be angelic, they could be mutants, they could be aliens, they could be fantasy creatures, they could be inanimate objects that can talk and have wills, like Toy Story. Toy Story is about toys, but the toys are persons because they have wills and desires and consciousness. And so that's really, if you're going to do a story, it's got to have persons as characters in it, otherwise it can't really go anywhere. And it might have a mixture of round and flat characters. Round characters are more nuanced. No character is ever like a human being, because human beings are infinite, you know, not infinitely, but extremely complex, more so than you can convey in a book. So you might have round characters that have more complexities, or flat characters that are really a particular type, and they conflict with other types, you know, the witty best friend, the femme fatale, the wise old sage. And flat characters are not necessarily bad. Many of Charles Dickens' characters in his works are flat. Even their names reveal important parts of their personality, and they stay pretty flat. The characters in Great Expectations don't change that much through the story, but it's their interactions that matter. And then, of course, you got main and minor characters. Usually, you should have at least one main character. It could just be the main character. Could be man versus nature, man versus God, man versus himself is the plot. But usually you got the main character and then the minor characters, which is kind of like on Star Trek. You had Kirk and Spock and Zulu and Chekhov, and you had the main characters, you had the minor characters, which are basically just the red shirts. The red shirts went there down with the team, beamed down to the alien planet, and they existed just to get shot. That way Bones can lean over and say, "He's dead, Jim." So I borrowed that my professor bought, that my professor. It's a great course that I bought, but I feel like he's speaking to me when I listen to the class, and it's helpful. Maybe you feel like I'm speaking to you. So you're getting a second-rate literature professor here. So I would encourage you, if you have an app to get the great courses, the one on writing great fiction, I thought was incredibly helpful. But then you have to make another decision when you're writing fiction. And when you're reading fiction, you should keep this in mind. Whose point of view is being told? What point of view are you going to tell the story from? Or are you going to switch? Sometimes books change points of view. So what are points of view, or POV? Let's go through those. So the first one is first person. So first person perspective or point of view would be when the novel is written from the perspective of the main character or a main character. Because sometimes in works of literature, a new character will narrate the story from his or her perspective, but they use a lot of first-person language. I did this. I was thinking, I want to do that. We all got together. So it seems like the narrator is speaking to you directly, but it's a character within the story that is speaking to you. Now, this opens up other opportunities for the first-person narrator. For example, some stories have unreliable narrators, that it's being narrated to you first-person by the character. I did this, we did that, I longed for her, but they're unreliable. You're like, maybe they're not telling you the whole story, or maybe they're not entirely right there. The most famous example of an unreliable narrator in literature is probably Lolita. Who wrote that? It was Vladimir Nabokov. Vladimir Nabokov wrote Lolita in 1955. Controversial work. It's not erotica. It's not pornography, but it does have adult themes within it. It's a first-person narration about Humbert, who ends up being a boarder with a woman who has a 12-year-old girl, a 12-year-old daughter. And previously, I think he had been in love with a girl who was like 15 or 16 years old when he was younger, and she died of like cholera or typhus or something. And so he's been fixated on very young girls ever since, who he calls nymphettes. And he becomes fascinated with this woman's daughter, Dolores, who goes by various nicknames, including Lolita. And so he becomes fascinated with her, and he ends up marrying the mom, who's attracted to him, just so he can stay within that girl's life. And it's kind of a tragic downward spiral ever since. But as you read through it, and especially as you get to the end of the book, you see, oh, wait a minute, maybe everything that Humbert was telling me, it doesn't all 100% add up. So that's an example from literature, Lolita. Another famous example of the use of the first person would be a technique called stream of consciousness, like in Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. Probably the most famous example of stream of consciousness, though, is James Joyce's novel Ulysses. So Ulysses is a retelling of Homer's Odyssey, but it takes place in Ireland, I think like in the 19th century. And it uses a first-person perspective, but it's told stream of consciousness. So as you read, it feels like you are in the character's mind himself. And it's because if you tried to write down every thought that you had, it would be a jumbled, crazy mess, right? I mean, we've got like kind of a regulator in our brains to keep our thoughts from driving us crazy. But we get all this sensory stimulus and all these random thoughts that pop up. So when a great writer can do stream of consciousness, it really takes you in a deep dive into another person's mind. Here's an excerpt from Ulysses. A quarter after, what an unearthly hour, I suppose, there. Just getting up in China now, combing out their pigtails for the day. We'll soon have the nuns ringing the Angelus there. Nobody coming in to spoil their sleep except an odd priest or two for his night office, or the alarm lock next door, a cockshut clattering the brain out of itself. Let me see if I can doze off. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What kind of flowers are those? They invented like the stars. The wallpaper in Lombard Street was much nicer. The apron he gave me was like that. Something I only wore it twice. Better lower this lamp. Try again so I can get up early. You're like, what is that? Ulysses is a good book to listen by audiobook. It becomes hypnotic to be sunk through, but it's easy to say, wait, what in the world was that? So you also have to, there's a virtue in doing the audiobook of Ulysses or trying to read it carefully to see what is going on here. So that's one perspective. You might try first person with your fiction account. Are you going to write from you're the character and you see through the character's eyes through the rest of the story? Or maybe you want to take a step back to look at different characters. Maybe you want to have a bigger perspective, and that would be third person. So the narrator in this case, the one who is describing the story, is not one of the characters in the story, but a third person narrator, either a limited one or an omniscient one. So an omniscient third person narrator, which by the way, in my fictional novel I'm working on, I am for now going with third person omniscient. I have a narrator who knows what all the characters think and what they do and reveals that to you. An example of third-person omniscient would be The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Here's a passage where the narrator says of the main character, "She had wandered without rule or guidance in a moral wilderness, as vast, as intricate and shadowy as the untamed forest, amid the gloom of which they are now holding a colloquy that was to decide their fate." So here the narrator is telling you what she thinks. She wandered in a vast moral wilderness. It's talking not about her literally doing things out in the world, but about what's going on in her heart, in her mind. So a third person omniscient narrator is helpful in getting into the minds of different characters, but you got to be careful not to be patronizing with the third person omniscient character, like they're almost too involved in the story or they overly explain things. But third person doesn't have to be omniscient. You can have a third person narrator who is limited. And this third person narrator, so the one that I'm like in Scarlet Letter, which is apropos, it's a religious novel, and the one in mine, it's kind of like if God were here telling you about the story, because he can see within the hearts of men, knows all that happens, has happened, will happen, and is going on in people's hearts and minds. The third person, that's why we say the third person narrator in this case is omniscient or all-knowing. But you can have a limited third-person narrator. So a limited third-person narrator would be a narrator. It would be like if a surveillance camera could tell you what's happening in a story. The camera can't tell you what's going on in the people's minds, but it can tell you what everything looks like. And you feel like you're kind of peering over the fence or looking behind the door, and the story's happening in front of you like a stage play. So here's an example from Dashiell Hammett's novel, The Maltese Falcon, later, of course, made into a play, into a movie with Humphrey Bogart. Samuel Spade's jaw was long and bony, his chin a jutting V under the more flexible V of his mouth. His nostrils curved back to make another smaller V. His yellow-gray eyes were horizontal. The V motif was picked up again by thickish brows rising outward from twin creases above a hooked nose, and his pale brown hair grew down from high, flat temples and a point on his forehead. He looked rather pleasantly like a blonde Satan. He said to Effie Perrine, "Yes, sweetheart?" She was a lanky, sunburned girl whose tan dress of thin woolen stuff clung to her with an effect of dampness. Her eyes were brown and playful in a shiny, boyish face. She finished shutting the door behind her, leaned against it, and said, "There's a girl wants to see you. Her name's Wonderly." "Customer?" "I guess so. You'll want to see her anyway. She's a knockout." "Shoo her in, darling," said Spade. "Shoo her in." Effie Perrine opened the door again, following it back into the outer office, standing with a hand on the knob while saying, "Will you come in, Miss Wonderly?" A voice said, "Thank you," so softly that only the purest articulation made the words intelligible, and a young woman came through the doorway. She advanced slowly with tentative steps, looking at Spade with cobalt blue eyes that were both shy and probing. So here, notice what's happening with the narrator in The Maltese Falcon. No one's telling you what Spade thinks or what Perrine thinks or what Mrs. Wonderly. You don't get, no one is being described what their thoughts are. You just get what people look like and what they do. You get see, touch, taste, hear, and smell. That's all you get from the narrator, and you have to infer everything else a lot from dialogue. So that's important when you write fiction. You want to use dialogue and understand two things. Dialogue can never be realistic. When you listen to people talk to each other in real life, it's disjointed, it's incomplete, it would not work well in a book. If you read a transcript, that's why I always cringe when I read transcripts of this podcast. They post them on Catholic.com sometimes. When you read the transcript of the podcast, I'm like, oh, I'm all disjointed, what am I doing? Because I write in a different voice than how I speak. It's almost like there are two different Trents. There's the Trent who does this podcast, who is talking to you directly. But when I write a book, it's completely different. If I wrote a book exactly how I spoke to you on this podcast, it would be so disjointed and hard to read. But at the same time, if I wrote out every word of this podcast and read it to you, it would not have the same appeal, would not have the same authenticity as if I'm sitting down with you telling you about this really neat stuff. So there's always trade-offs in this. So, all right, so we saw, you know, when you write fiction, you got first person and you got third person, right? And that's all you got. That's actually not all you got. There is a tiny minority in fiction writing. There's very few examples of this because it is a bizarre kind of writing style. So first person is I, from the character's perspective. Third person is the narrator is outside of the characters. Then there's second person. What in the world could a second person point of view be in a novel? So first person is through one of the characters. Third person is someone detached from the characters. Second person is you are the character. So a second person novel would be, it's basically a first person novel, but instead of the pronouns I, or he or they or we, it's you. You are one of the characters. You are the character in the novel. And so it's written from your perspective in it, and it's described in that way. So it's first person. It's through your eye. It's through the eyes of the character, but you are the character. A famous example of this is Jay McInerney's book, Bright Lights, Big City, which was later turned into a movie with Michael J. Fox. Actually, the most common example you see of second person narration are choose your own adventure books. I loved choose your own adventure books growing up. There were all different kinds of styles, and you would read it and it would say, you are in the wizard's palace. And he says, you ought not touch anything. I'll be right back, but you can't help yourself. And you see a purple vial and a blue vial. Which one do you pick up? And, you know, go to page 54 for purple and go to page 82 for blue. And you would go through. So choose your own adventure. It works because it feels like you're telling the story by choosing which page to go through. Now, I always cheated as a kid, and I would flip through and find the end page that I thought was the best and work my way backwards. You couldn't imagine how I do this in a novel. Here's how Bright Lights, Big City starts. You are not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are. And you cannot say that the terrain is entirely unfamiliar, although the details are fuzzy. You were at a nightclub talking to a girl with a shaved head. The club is either Heartbreak or the Lizard Lounge. Oh, this is like in 1980s Miami or something, by the way. All might come clear if you could just slip into the bathroom and do a little more Bolivian marching powder. Yeah, it's 1980s Miami, probably. That's cocaine. Then again, it might not. A small voice inside you insists that this epidemic lack of clarity is a result of too much of that already. The night has already turned on that imperceptible pivot where 2 a.m. changes to 6 a.m. You know this moment has come and gone, but you're not yet willing to concede that you have crossed the line beyond which all is gratuitous damage and the palsy of unraveled nerve endings. Somewhere back there, you could have cut your losses. But you rode past that moment on a comet trail of white powder, and now you are trying to hang on to the rush. Your brain at this moment is composed of brigades of tiny Bolivian soldiers. They are tired and muddy from their long march through the night. There are holes in their boots, and they are hungry. They need to be fed. They need the Bolivian marching powder. So there's something that's different. I've never read all of Bright Light's Big City, and I don't intend to. Second person, it feels a little gimmicky to me. I couldn't quite get through it all, but I give kudos and props to those who try doing different narrative functions. And finally, there's a structure of your plot. What structure are you going to go with? Now, of course, there's the classic hero's journey. This is used to great effect in Star Wars. Also, there's Freytag's Pyramids. I'll start with the more basic one, then I'll end with the more complex plot structure. Freytag's Pyramid is very basic. Almost every plot follows it, but some authors are very skilled. They can subvert Freytag's Pyramid. He was a 19th century German author, and he says nearly all plots follow this frame of thought. Exposition, rising action, climax, falling action, denouement. Denouement is a French word that means to untie. It means like, you know, you're finally unraveling the threads of the plot and we're done. Whereas it's weird, you think at the end of the story, it should be you tie up the loose threads, right? So the professor in my class used The Wizard of Oz as an example, and I like this. So exposition. Dorothy's in Kansas. She has her little dog Toto. And there's the evil lady who later becomes the Wicked Witch of the West who wants to kill her dog, Toto, have it put down because Toto bit her. And we meet Auntie M, the farmhands. We get a feel for Dorothy's life in Kansas. Exposition. Rising action. The tornado strikes. Dorothy gets swept away to Oz. She goes along the yellow brick road, meets the Scarecrow, encounters trials along the way with the Wicked Witch. And then she is told to go and retrieve the witch's broom, and Dorothy gets captured. The Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion go to rescue her, and it all culminates at the castle of the Wicked Witch of the West. Oh, and then we have the climax of The Wizard of Oz, when the bucket of water is poured on the Wicked Witch, and she goes, I'm melting, oh, what a world, I'm melting. And that's the climax, the most exciting part of the novel. Then the falling action, everything with the wizard. They go back to the Emerald City. The wizard's revealed for who he is. The Scarecrow, everyone gets something that they need. The Tin Man gets a heart. The Scarecrow, I don't got any brains. Ah, you don't need brains. Most of these people don't have brains anyway. All you need is a diploma, which is still the lesson today because college is worthless. You probably got brains in your head. For some reason, you just need a diploma to prove it to people. So still relevant today. And then the wizard gets in the balloon to take Dorothy away. But he leaves without her. And then we get a little bit of a deus ex machina when Glinda the Good Witch shows up, says, click your heels 3 times. You could have always gone home. Thanks, Glinda. And then she gets back. And then Dorothy is back in Kansas again. And denouement. It all is untied or tied up, depending on what metaphor you prefer to use. So Freytag's Pyramid. Exposition, rising action, climax, falling action, denouement. Try to see when you can spot it in things that you hear. Though the hero's journey, if you want to especially have an adventure story that goes well, watch most adventure stories. Watch most of them. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter what genre it is. Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Rocky, Hunger Games, whatever it might be, it usually follows this framework. The hero's journey, first identified, I believe, by Joseph Campbell in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And it basically goes like this. It's a 12-step plot. Star Wars follows it almost beat for beat in Episode 4, A New Hope. So here they are, the 12 steps. The ordinary world. Our protagonist is in his regular spot, living his regular thing. I'll follow Star Wars, but occasionally I'll throw other elements in. Frodo in the Shire, Katniss in the District, and Luke on Tatooine. And I need to go pick up some power, I was going to pick up some power converters at Tachi Station. Then the call of adventure. Then he meets Obi-Wan when going after the droid. Luke meets Obi-Wan Kenobi. And they get the message from Leia. Please, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. You must join me too. You must be trained to become a Jedi if you're to join me. And he says, I can't do that. The harvest just started. I'd love to help, but it's the Empire. I can't get involved in that. Then Luke goes back, and he goes back to find a very extra crispy Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru at their home, which has been attacked by stormtroopers. Look at these blast marks. Only Imperial stormtroopers could be this precise. Really, Obi-Wan? Wait till you get later in the movie and you see how imprecise they are as they're shooting. So we have the call, but then the next is, sorry, the refusal. So ordinary world, call of adventure, refusal of the call. Luke says, I can't do that. I got to get back to the farm. Then meeting the mentor. So Luke kind of already met the mentor, but now he's signed up with Obi-Wan. There's nothing for me here. I want to go with you to help the rebels. I want to become a Jedi like my father. You want to be exactly like your father, Luke. He was not that great of an actor. We'll find that out later in about 30 years. So step four, meets the mentor. Step five, crossing the threshold. Now we're entering into danger. Frodo goes on the journey to Mount Doom, meets the Ringwraiths. Katniss enters into the district. And Luke goes to Mos Eisley, all kinds of a hive of scum and villainy. And he almost, you know, gets killed by a guy at the bar at the Mos Eisley Cantina. But then number six, tests, allies and enemies. Katniss meets friends and other people she's going to have to fight in the Hunger Game division. Frodo meets allies, the elves and the dwarves, but then other people sent after him to get the ring. And then Luke, of course, and Obi-Wan meet up with Han Solo and Chewbacca, and then they get pursued by the stormtroopers. Number seven, you approach the inmost cave. Now we're in the thick of it. Now we're caught in the tractor beam. We're going into the Death Star. Now we're in the arena in the Hunger Game. Now we're going to step into the ring with Apollo Creed. We're going. The inmost cave is not a literal cave, but it's the place of danger. We're going into the beyond, and we're going to be challenged. And here is where it starts. Then the ordeal. Then we're hitting the moment of realizing I may have gotten in over my head. What am I doing here? And in Star Wars, it would probably be the ordeal is when they escape from the Death Star and they're on their way out, but Obi-Wan Kenobi sacrifices himself and Luke goes, no! And so, you know, he's fighting with Darth Vader and it looks like two septuagenarians kind of touching lightsabers. Their duels are not really good. I was once the student. Now I am the master. Only a master of evil, Darth. Darth is a title, Obi-Wan, but all right. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. And then he does. And Luke was probably feeling like, what do I do without Obi-Wan? I'm nothing. That's the ordeal. And you can see this in other, you know, when Frodo fails initially in his quest to return the ring. We like, what am I doing? I'm in over my head. Step nine, the reward. Seizing the sword. I've got the weapon of power now. I've got a means to fight back. In Star Wars, Luke has the plans for the Death Star. He escapes to Yavin 4. Now he and the rebels have a fighting chance to bring down the Death Star. They know its weakness, but we're almost home. Step 10 is the road back. We still have to climb over. There's still challenges before we can meet our ultimate end here. We still have to overcome this last hurdle. And so for Luke, it would be the trench battle, flying in his X-Wing. He's got to shoot the photon torpedoes into the exhaust tube. The Y-Wings have already failed in that regard. How is he going to do it? Luke, use the Force, Luke. He turned off his targeting computer. Don't worry, I'm all right. And then he says he feels the Force. And destroys the Death Star. That's resurrection, step 11, that the hero is reborn at this moment. The Death Star is destroyed. Katniss and Peeta have foiled the Hunger Games. We're not going to do this anymore. And then the Game Master says, stop! And they're, you know, we're not going to leave a victor. We'll both die if we have to. And they're reborn now at this moment and have defeated the final enemy. And finally, 12, return with the elixir. So we've come into a full circle. Now the hero has returned. The hero has returned to where he once was. Frodo's back in the Shire. Rocky's just hanging out at the restaurant in Philadelphia. Luke is now back with the rebels. He's maybe not returned to the same place, but the conflict is over. And the hero's returned, but the hero is different. The hero has changed. He has something new. He's come back with something. He's changed of attitude or a special object. Luke's got his little award at the award ceremony at the end of episode 4. Which, by the way, why doesn't Chewie get a medal? Han gets a medal. Luke gets a medal. But Chewbacca doesn't get a medal. Messed up, man. It's anti-Wookiee prejudice. I don't like it. A contemporary example of this, to remember this, is another way of looking at the hero's journey that's less complex. Dan Harmon, who's the creator of Rick and Morty, which is a morally offensive cartoon, but one that is expertly written, so You know, if you can handle morally offensive things, it's a piece of art that's worth considering to check out, especially for a story structure. The stories work well because when Harmon writes a theme or a script for Rick and Morty, he always follows this same pattern, a story circle, he calls it. And it always goes the same way in every episode, which works well for a television anthology. 1 through 8. 1, a character is in a zone of comfort. 2, but they want something. 3, they enter an unfamiliar situation. 4, they adapt to it. 5, they get what they wanted. 6, they pay a heavy price for it in doing so. 7, they return to their familiar situation, but 8, they've changed in the process. So that's kind of the hero's journey in a nutshell, the Harmon story circle. You can look that up online and see, read like how it's portrayed like in a typical Rick and Morty episode, like Morty Night Run. These episodes, yeah, I can tell you, they're not for the faint of heart. There's morally offensive elements in them, but they're very smartly written. So when you have things in culture, there's stuff that's high quality art, low quality morals. You've got high quality morals, low quality art, which is a lot of Christian films, frankly. And you've got the rare gems, high quality art and high quality morals. Oh, I love it. Beckett, A Man for All Seasons, is beautiful. And then most of society, you get low-quality art and low-quality morals, which is most things you can find on cable television or MTV. Like Temptation Island, low-quality art, low-quality morals. We should shoot, though, for high-quality art, high-quality morals. And if you are writing a fiction book, I hope you will do that. Now, here's the thing. You write fiction, it can have high-quality morals with evil characters. Remember that. If you want to show that you ought to be a good person, your narrative may have a very bad person in it, and that's okay. Don't make it squeaky clean. And the protagonists don't have to be perfect. They shouldn't be, because they should be real people. And real people, well, they just aren't perfect. It's a lesson that I learn every day. Lesson you probably learn as well, but we always try to grow day by day. Thanks for stopping with me on this Free For All Friday. And I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.